Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we've got another one of those beautiful blue sky days with warm temperatures and long hours of sun. Maybe you've even spent some time out on your deck just soaking it in. Weather like this puts me in the mindset to garden. A few weeks ago when I asked Julie Riley at Cooperative Extension if April was too soon for a gardening show, she said, definitely not. Gardeners go a little stir crazy in April and there's a lot to do in April. So that's our topic today, how best to spend April, getting ready for gardening season. We'll be talking seed starts, snow removal, soil preparation, planning your garden, and maybe even some new local trends in gardening. We'll even talk a little bit about indoor gardening for those who might not have a yard. So joining Julie Riley from the Cooperative Extension, I'd like also to welcome Kelly Ingram from the Alaska Botanical Garden. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you here. And Una Martin from, I hope I get this right, the Alaska chapter of the American Association of Landscape Architects.
Very close. Thank you for having me. Yeah, Society.
Society.
ASLA.
Okay, Society. And a creative gardener herself. So I also want to welcome our listeners because we really invite your gardening questions and your ideas. How do you spend April getting ready to grow things? And have you ever started your seeds too early and had to toss them because they were all leggy by the time they were supposed to go in the ground? So we hope you'll give us a call and share some of your information. I'm going to give you our numbers, 550-8433 if you're in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 if you're outside of Anchorage. And you can always send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. And as we sort of talk about gardening, we do have some links on our website at Alaska Public. We're going to talk about some classes, and I think we're going to add some more links because as we've been sitting here before the show talking, there's more classes than I knew about. So first, let's do a little round robin with our guests. We do have three fabulous gardeners who also are in the position to meet new gardeners and experienced gardeners. And so we're going to meet them and find out a little bit about what kind of gardener they are and what organization they represent. So let's start with you, Julie.
Thanks, Kathleen. I am a veg head. I grew my first vegetable garden by reading the back of the seed packets when I was 17 or 18 years old. So I am really tickled that everybody in Anchorage seems to want to grow vegetables these past few years.
Okay.
I work for Cooperative Extension Service, and 2014 will be my 30th year teaching gardening.
Wow. Congratulations, Julie. We are lucky to have you. What an asset for Anchorage to have. And so you still garden, even though you talk to gardeners all day long and all summer long and go to Saturday markets and all that, do you still garden?
I have a very modest container garden. I grew a giant cabbage that I wheeled down the street last September to display at the home show in September.
Uh-huh.
And
so you have
flowers and herbs. And actually, I love fireweed, so I'd have fireweed by my back door in
mm-hmm.
a pot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you target your gardening. Very targeted gardening. How about you, Kelly? Tell us a little bit about you.
I'm the program director and volunteer coordinator over at the Alaska Botanical Garden. And I'm really excited to be there and learning so much from expert gardeners like Julie and Una. I started gardening in college. We had a farm where I went to school, and so I spent a summer or two working on the farm and then came up here and actually worked with Julie over at the Refugee Garden in Mountain View. And from there, I really fell in love with vegetable gardening primarily, and I've been hooked ever since.
So how long have you been in Alaska?
I've been in Alaska on and off since 2009. Mm-hmm. I was here for a year, and then I went back to North Carolina, where I'm from, but I couldn't stay away. I love it so much up here, so I came back a few years ago.
Okay, well, mm-hmm. great. And Una, tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, thanks. I moved to Anchorage in 2002. I've been practicing landscape architecture here since then. I am here representing the Alaska chapter of American Society of Landscape Architects. April is National Landscape Architecture Month, and landscape architecture is just one of those really great things that's happening in Anchorage. It's evident in our parks and trails and our urban design areas and our public gardens and all of these different areas, whether they're with the National Park Service, Forest Service, State Parks, within the municipality. Landscape architects are working on a project mm-hmm. that'll benefit you. And so I have been gardening in Anchorage since I moved here in 2002. I lived in an apartment and had a community garden through Parks and Recreation for a couple of years before I moved into a home that was a rental but had a small plot of land.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm a homeowner, just like many people, and have gotten to enjoy that, the trials and tribulations of having a large area.
Did you buy your home based on southern exposure or anything
you
like
know,
that?
You know, I did. I totally did. I wanted to have a large area that was southern exposure. So the back of our house and the backyard is southern exposure. So we can enjoy the most of that.
And
but,
things.
I mean, you know, that the downside is that the front is north facing. So, you know.
I
somewhere is facing south.
North is always there somewhere, that'll be one of my questions, because I've just got like moss all over my front yard, and I don't know whether I should just give it over to the moss or whatever. So anyway, I told our guests that we were going to start off just inviting each one of them to tell us what they would say is the most important or best use of your time in April. Give us one thing. There's a thousand things you could be doing, but we're going to go back to Julie and just sort of let her make a pitch.
Shovel the snow off. Spread wood ashes on the snow so it melts faster. Get ready to plant earlier, because even though the fall season seems to have extended, you know, longer into September, if we can get 2 weeks ahead of the game at the front end of the season, we'll be harvesting peas 1st of July.
You know, just before I came in here, someone stopped me and said, I've been shoveling snow onto my perennials. So,
well, that's perennials. Yes. Yeah. So I'm a veg head. I got vegetables on the brain.
So people should be shoveling snow onto their perennials, maybe, but shoveling it off their vegetable gardens.
Depends on how cold it's going to get.
Yeah.
No, Una's got an opinion there.
Well, I can just relate that having been in my home now since 2008, it's really interesting to write down as the snow starts to melt and note each time, which year, which date you have a snow-free yard. And it's exciting to kind of take pictures of the areas that melt the fastest, because those are going to be your microclimates and your warmest spots in your yard, which would get is informative if you want to do perennials or if you would like to plant or set out containers. You can find those spots that are hot.
Yeah.
You know, I look for tulips on the south side blooming, you know, April 11th usually.
Yeah.
But there could be a whole month difference. But
depending where you are in Anchorage, your snow-free yard, being in East Anchorage, admittedly, it's closer to May 1st.
yeah. I know. I tried to put tulips right next to my house, and they were just so wimpy and sickly, and I never did it again. And I kind of gave the whole thing over to raspberries, and so they are so happy. But it's kind of like they probably would have been happy anywhere. They didn't really need the best spot. In the garden.
There's nothing wrong with the path of least resistance sometimes.
Okay. I don't have to slip my gardening wrists over that. But so how about you, Kelly? What do you think?
Oh, well, right now I'm really getting antsy to plant outside, like Julie was saying. But if we can extend that season and start some seeds indoors, now is the perfect time to start some of those longer season vegetables, like some tomatoes and peppers, if you have a little warm spot to keep them in, to keep them out of the cold when cold summer nights, or get some of your brassicas, your broccoli, cauliflower started. Now's definitely the time. Or if you want to just are super antsy and want to grow a little greens inside, you can do that too.
I want to talk about that just because, well, for one thing, some people might not really have a yard, you know, and so and Una and I were talking before the show a little bit about people's concern about where their food comes from and the desire that maybe they want organic greens or something like that. And so we'll touch on that as we go along here. So that's great, because I know you have a lot of indoor growing experience, right?
We do. We've had a great winter of growing greens and salads.
With school kids, right?
Yes. We're working with the 21st Century After School Program through the Anchorage School District. And we've been growing loads of salads and herbs and some nasturtiums and flowers, too. So it's been a huge success for our program.
Okay, so we heard from Julie, shovel off the snow, watch your perennials, because maybe you want to shovel some snow on there. We heard about planting from Una. You know, it's a great time, because it actually, once it disappears, you don't remember.
You don't remember. You think you would, but you just don't.
Yeah, I know. I always wish that I kept, you know, a calendar of, you know, first snows.
There you go.
Yeah.
May 18th, it snowed last year.
It did.
That is going to stick forever in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. It can go south on you very, very quickly here, you know, even when, I mean, we probably had an April like this last year, didn't we? Didn't we have a nice April?
I don't remember.
Well, everybody was afraid that breakup was going to be so terrible because we had all that snow.
Yeah.
Or was that the year before?
I know. It's really, see, this is the value of keeping records.
Records are really helpful. Mm-hmm. And the pictures are really helpful, especially if you do have a yard and you want to see shift.
Develop it
in any way. What I have learned is that nothing happens in one season, that you get glimpses and information over time that you live in a space. And biting off little bits at a time, things that you can manage, are mm-hmm. really helpful.
That's good advice. I mean, you know, don't panic. Take deep breaths.
Take deep breaths.
Take one step at a time. Okay.
Watch where the snow melts first, because, you know, if you're going to do vegetables, I think, you know, that's key. Because when we moved into our house, you know, the previous owner had put up a buffer zone of small trees right where it was the sunniest. And so trees had to go because that's where the vegetables needed to be. So April is the time to do that.
To figure that out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a great time.
Another question I have for you guys is, and I have a sneak preview answer from Julie, but what's a tool that you really love and maybe other gardeners might not be aware of it? And Julie, I'm alluding to something to do with thermometers. if you're looking at me going, what is she talking about?
No, I knew. And actually, there's two thermometers that I think gardeners need to get. If you have a greenhouse, you need a minimum maximum thermometer. Kelly talked about tomatoes and peppers. And, you know, if you're starting in the house and planning to put those into an unheated greenhouse, you need to know how cold it's getting at night. And you don't want to camp out there, so you need a minimum maximum thermometer. And they're not very easy to find. And then the other tool is a soil thermometer.
Okay.
Because when the soil is 45 degrees, you can plant spinach, you can plant peas, and how are you going to know unless you have the thermometer? And last May, the end of May, the soil was still even frozen in spots. So mm-hmm. it's a tool that not a lot of gardeners think about because you just use it for a very short period of time. Although in the greenhouse, the minimum maximum thermometer, you know, you should really have that be checking it throughout the season.
I'm interested that you say it's hard to find. And I guess I'm thinking if any of the gardening centers are listening, this is a tool that Anchorage needs and Anchorage gardeners need. Do you generally find them online, Julie, or do you just dig till you find them?
I'm a local shopper, so okay. I mean, you can find them, but you have to look. And thanks for your plug to the local businesses.
Yeah,
to stock those.
Yeah, so a minimum maximum thermometer for the greenhouse, and then a soil thermometer for the ground.
Right, and then later you're going to need a compost thermometer too. But
mm-hmm. oh yeah, I want to talk compost because I have like a compost pile that isn't doing anything. So, but we'll get there. How about you, Kelly? What's a tool that you really love?
Oh goodness, my one thing that I really love, which this is completely different from what Julie was talking about, but is a hula hoe. And it's just, I just think it's a really cute little, it's just kind of fun to use. I guess I enjoy the process of using it a lot, which it's just this hoe that has a little movable end to the bottom, and it helps with weeding and kind of loosening up the ground at the very top. So that's my favorite thing.
So is it like a double-edged thing, or?
No, and Julie, can you... It's a
piece of metal that you know that wobbles just the way you described.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But I think you should talk about lights for indoor growing right now.
Oh yes, we could definitely talk about lights.
Let's do that.
So, lights are can do so much if you can get just two fluorescent or a fluorescent light that has two bulbs. A T5 T5 bulbs are the way to go. But that is a huge tool that is not very expensive, and you can grow amazing things indoors using that.
What's a T5? Is it those long ones?
Yeah, so there's different, it's a smaller size bulb than maybe your T8 or your 12, or T5. Yeah, so very similar to the fluorescent bulbs you have inside buildings, but it's a little bit smaller bulb, but it produces more light. And you can actually get a red bulb and a blue bulb, so it's more of the natural light spectrum and resembles more outdoor light. And so it makes the plants a lot happier, and and you can grow. We've actually gotten tomatoes to flower using that, and gotten tomatoes
like in January or something.
Yeah, we made salsa in January.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, your lettuces in the schools look so fabulous. So you've got the right light. They're perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Julie, anything to add to that?
And lights? No, nothing
to add to lights. What I was going to ask was, you mean I can just shove these things up against a window and I'm okay? But really, that isn't okay because they're going to grow toward the light. And my seedlings is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and right now we are getting a lot more light. You typically need about 12 to 14 hours of bright light to really make your plants happy. So you can definitely grow them in the windowsill, but if you are kind of on that buffer and you don't want to be constantly turning your plants around so they're not leaning so much towards the window, a little grow light like that is perfect.
Yeah.
But I do think you're right that using some artificial light in conjunction with natural window light makes a big difference for starting seedlings. But, you know, the botanical garden has got kids growing vegetables with no natural window light in some locations. They're just, you know, using these fluorescent T5, is that what you said?
Yeah, T5. Yeah.
And you have to have, do you make a little frame for it? I mean, and how far up does it have to be from the soil? I mean, I don't know those things.
Oh, no, those are great questions.
I should go to her class.
I should go to your, can I go to an elementary school class?
Yeah, maybe we should have a workshop on this.
Yeah.
We actually just got shelves from Costco, or those kind of three or four metal shelving units. And then we have the lights, and we use chain on each side so that you can raise and lower the light so that it's close to the plant. So you want about 4 inches away, much more than that, and they're going to start to get a little leggy and kind of...
4 inches, wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty close. So you don't want them touching the light, but they're not really... we haven't seen them burning or anything unless they're actually... touching the light right there.
Yeah,
so then you can move it up as they grow and get bigger.
Okay, so I'm getting inspired already. I'm thinking I'm going to do that. Because we really have 8 weeks yet before we probably can get out. So you could actually, what could you get growing in 8 weeks that you could you get anything that you could eat in 8 weeks?
Oh, we've gotten a whole salad in 4 weeks. So we can grow, you can grow lettuce, braising greens like kale and mustards. We've grown some herbs, and granted they're not as big as they could be, but just to add them in, like cilantro and basil, a little flavor, some sorrel. It's
very
full
possible.
Salad in,
very
in 30
possible.
Days.
So. Yeah. If you've just joined us, you can probably tell we're talking about gardening because everybody's itching to get out there. We've had beautiful long days and warm weather during the day, even though it's can still be pretty chilly at night. So we're trying to feed your fantasies about gardening. And we just want to let you know we've got great experts on the show today. Julie Riley from Cooperative Extension, Kelly Ingram from the Alaska Botanical Garden, and Una Martin from the Alaska Chapter of the American Society of Landscape Architects. Great.
Bingo.
Let's go to you and hear your tool.
Oh, yeah. The tools, and I'd like to just share a term that I first heard through Jeff Lowenfels, and it's called yardener. And so that's the kind of gardener I tend to be. So the first tool that jumped into my mind is my fire pit.
Oh.
Because one of the things as a homeowner, we'd struggle with, let's say, a whole bunch of fallen twigs and different branches and what to do, how to manage that. And you could pile it all up and make a little habitat for little bugs and creatures to live in, or you can sort of burn it over time as you enjoy your summer.
That's
fire pit. And so the tool, you know, using the Garden Design Workshop, which is their annual fundraiser, which is starting on April 14th, this is a great way to sort of think about the different elements that you'd need in your yard to make your life easier. And the tool doesn't necessarily have to be this something that you can hold in your hand. It can be the way you move and use your yard.
Yeah, I had not thought of the fire pit. I struggle with what to do with all that vegetation.
Yeah, we all do.
You don't want to throw it away. I think I should compost it only, and I hope we talk a little bit about composting because I'm not successful. You know, what to do with all that vegetation. My husband, when he mows the lawn, he will fill up a trash can with green grass and say, I know you need this. And then it'll sit there, and I don't know what to do with it. So,
oh, we can tell you what to do with it?
Yeah.
Can't we?
Yeah.
I mean, I can start.
Let me just throw out our numbers. I meant to do that. 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 outside of Anchorage. Or you can send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. Okay, tell me about compost. Jump in. Who wants to jump in?
Well... compost is, as all that green grass that you just mentioned, if you piled it in a heap, it would just stink.
Yes, it gets wet and soggy and yeah. smelly and slimy.
Yeah, so you need to stockpile your leaves in the fall. Or not rake in the fall, better yet, and then just rake them all up in the spring and pile them next to your compost. And then every time you mow your lawn, you mix in your brown leaves, because the ratio of nitrogen to carbon being the brown stuff, leaves, twigs, all of those dead things. Mm-hmm. And green stuff, it's nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So you think of that relationship, and 2-to-1, 4-to-1, carbon. I didn't write it down before I come, but you'd sort of a feel. You wanted this compost to be not soaking, not so green. You want a lot more brown, and then it disappears.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I think that's the best piece of advice you can give people on composting, is to collect leaves in the fall, because you're right. You always have green. Even if you don't have a yard, you still have green weeds.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you need
and
to
you can
offset
go ahead
it with
and
carbon.
Compost those too.
You can compost weeds.
Yeah, you can compost those too.
No seeds, no flower heads. Two buckets when you weed. One for the compost. One not for the compost, so you don't add the weed seeds back.
That's information I didn't know either. So say that again, Julie.
Well, this is what we do. I'm a volunteer at the botanical garden out in the herb garden, and we always have two buckets. One for weeds to go on the compost pile, and one that we're not going to compost, because we don't want to perpetuate weeds if the compost pile doesn't heat up to the point where it's able to kill the weed seeds. So if you have large properties, you can, bury those seedy weeds if you're not going to be bringing them back up again, so that they're not going to show up to create more weeds. Or I guess, Una suggesting maybe to burn them. But, I was seeing a pile of twigs when you're talking about your fire pit, and I was thinking that that really was one of the trends when I went to Seattle to the flower show this year, is fire in the garden was something that many of the designers were talking about.
Wow. As a tool or just as an aesthetic
element or a tool? Yeah,
or both.
As a design element.
Yeah. It's just didn't really need. Our days are long, but our nights are still cool. The evenings are still cool. And so fire is a pretty neat thing.
Oh,
for example, in our house, for our home, when we renovated, we removed the fireplace, and we're able to use that skeleton of the fireplace as our fire pit. So we just spray painted the thing red and set it up on its old platform and built a little rocked area for it, so we could.
You took it outside.
We took it outside.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
So the wood ashes, though, that you get from the fire pit,
the
wood ashes
are
a good source of organic potassium, and they also can be used in lieu of limestone that's used to raise the pH of the soil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've got a question that came in from email. So listen up, guys, and here, tell us what you think. This is a fellow named Joe, and he says, I have a question about soil enrichment. For 2014, I plan to rest and lay fallow my 3 vegetable and herbal garden boxes. I'll weed as well as blend in last year's excellent compost. What soil-enriching legumes or other plant varieties should I sow this season?
Well, you've got two things going on there. One is you said lay fallow, which means not to have anything planted there. And then my immediate thought was to grow legumes instead so that you could enrich the soil.
Okay.
It sounds like you're an urban gardener with a small space with boxes or beds. So anything that you've got that is in the bean or pea family, and to use it as a green manure crop, you would be turning it into the soil when it's still green. So the fact that you're not going to try to garden in those boxes again this year, I think, is a critical point. So you understand what you're doing. So that's really.
So any bean or pea would be the answer,
right? And if you if you had a large area, you'd probably want to select some of the less expensive field peas, like they grow in farm fields.
Because you're just going to turn them under. You're not really going to get to harvest
them. Right, right, right.
How often should you do that, Julie? He says...
Well, Well, most gardeners aren't willing, you know, to do this, to miss a year. So this is a hard thing. And for a single season, you know, I think buckwheat makes a great cover crop, but it's not a legume.
So it's not going to give you some of the benefits.
Well, it doesn't have the same amount of nitrogen input, but it's fast, and in a single season you can be turning it over, and you don't want to let it go to seed because you don't want it to become a weed.
Mm-hmm. And other thoughts, Kelly or Una? Think she got that?
You know, but I don't know. In a small space garden, if that's the best thing to do, you know, why not just add
mulching
fish?
It with the compost is really great.
Yeah, add compost, fish, you know, why not use just, you know, fish? I mean, if you don't have fish waste, why not, you know, purchase one of the Alaskan fish fertilizer products?
You could put your kitchen waste in there.
I start and fail. So I have a little kitchen compost, you know. And I guess I just want to make sure, what can I put in there? Anything? I mean, coffee grounds, no bones, no fat, right? But fish fat is okay, right? Fish skin.
Well, the reason you're not,
it depends,
you know,
on the scale of your, how active your compost is. Wouldn't you agree? The compost, if it's not active and you put those things, I wouldn't put bones and meat products in there. Well, but people put eggshells and right. Fish skin, I have heard. I have put shrimp peelings in ours.
Yeah, I mean, it's all going to break down. I mean, you don't need to add the wood ashes to the compost pile because, you know, it doesn't need to biodegrade. But the reason you're not putting, you know, fats and bones in, I would add citrus peels to the list of things that are slow to break down, is because you don't want to attract dogs and bears and
other things.
It might be something philosophical with you not to add meat products to a compost pile. So, Kelly, what do you do at the botanical garden for composting?
Well, we actually don't add any food scraps into our compost because we are in an area where bears are pretty prevalent. So we just anything
smart
from the garden, but no food at all.
Nothing that might lure some wildlife. Yeah. We have a caller, so let's take this question. Hi, Rosemary, you're on Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Well, I don't have a question. I just want to say, Julie, save your shrimp shells for making a broth for the next time you cook something with fish. My rule of thumb, Rosie's rule of thumb, is not to start your veggie seeds for transplanting until you've paid your taxes on the 15th.
That's great.
I love it.
Rosemary, love it. How long have you been gardening in Alaska?
35 years.
And if you had to give one tip from all your years of experience, well, we got the shrimp shells, save them for broth, and start after tax day. Any other thing that you end up telling new gardeners over and over?
No, it's just pay your taxes.
No, she's the used predatory nematodes for root maggot control. That's what Rosemary taught me. She gardens down on the Kenai Peninsula.
Oh.
In beautiful suburban Sterling.
And so do you have seeds? You don't have your seeds out because you haven't paid your taxes yet?
I don't know. I haven't talked to the accountant. Well, the reason I say that, because the ideal size for a transplant in order to reduce transplant shock is 5 true leaves.
5 true leaves?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody's nodding their head here. They agree with you.
Well, yeah, Kathleen, when you mentioned throwing away your starts because they've gotten too big, you know, I wish people would do that, but I've never seen anybody brave enough. You know, they go out, and it is very difficult to harden plants off if they're too big.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, with broccoli or cabbage, you can plant them deeper because they'll put out adventitious roots.
Is that right? What does that mean?
They'll put out roots along the stalk.
Okay. So you could turn them under. In other words, if you grew some cabbage or something and they were too leggy, turn them under and they'll still come up? Is that what you're saying?
Plant them deeper.
No. Oh, plant them deeper. Okay.
Yeah, then that's important, even if they're not leggy.
You know, another way to keep warmth in the soil is to plant them sideways.
Yeah, that's the old tomato trick. If we've got tomatoes with a long stem too.
I see. So you plant them sideways and then coming up, kind of an L? That's interesting. Have you done that, Rosemary?
No, because I start my seeds, cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower, after the 15th of April.
At the right time.
All right. Well, Rosemary, thank you so much, and thanks for listening today.
You're welcome. Plant you now and dig you later.
So, you know, I'm wondering about compost and what a landscape architect would do with, you know, you mentioned a pile, but I'm sure that you get called upon to design structures or recommend, you know, in a...
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. This is the exciting part about having property, is that you do get to choose what is the most advantageous for you to, speaking of advantageous roots, you want to look at your land and say, it makes the most sense for me to keep my wheelbarrows here and my tools here. Therefore, I will keep my leaf pile here next to my working compost. In my personal yard, I have three composts, one that's just leaves, one that's last year's, and one that will be this year's. And so each, I draw from the one that was the year before, and then I'm working on the one that's this year's, and I have my leaf pile that continually feeds the one that's working. And it takes up a little bit of room. It's tucked behind a fern garden, so I don't see it once the ferns are grown. But it's just enough room for me to get my wheelbarrow back there and move things around. I don't do as much kitchen scraps as I would like. I save those for my chickens.
Oh, we have
but those,
chickens.
Which was one of the biggest draws for having the birds was their nitrogen source mixed with their hay and straw.
Right.
So your piles are loose.
Yeah,
which is what I prefer too.
Yeah, no, I prefer that as well. It's just much easier to have to turn them. You're not scraping your wrists or elbows reaching in. I mean, you can build them into. Some people like to build them into boxes, but I would recommend having one side completely open so you can get right in there, right to every corner.
You know what?
With your big
I have
extra tufts on.
A round thing that I think they were given away. Maybe,
uh-huh, the barrels.
And I got one of those, I tried to get in there. It's nothing's
is
happening.
Is it sticky?
I don't. I think it's just dry.
Add water.
Yeah, you know what you need to do is just pick it up and move it.
Uh huh.
Because it's impossible to get in there and turn it. It's not really designed.
So roll it.
Uh-huh. I mean, is it open on the bottom?
I think it is open on
the bottom. Just pick it up, move it, and then shovel the compost back
and
in,
then
back
put
into
it. Back
it.
On. Okay. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a little break. I'm talking with Julie Riley from Cooperative Extension, Kelly Ingram from the Alaska Botanical Garden, and Una Martin from the Landscape Architects. And, you know, think about your questions. What do you need to ask or share with us some of your own ways of surviving April till you can actually get your hands in dirt? So we'll be right back. And this is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. We've been talking about gardening and composting and soil enhancement and all kinds of things like that. When we left off, we were talking a little bit about composting, and we're going to dive back into that just a little bit because during the break, Kelly brought up worm composting. So let's hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, so coming from an indoor perspective, I've gardened at community gardens quite a bit, but this summer is actually my first summer with a yard and a compost system. So indoors, you can use a worm composting system. If you just chop up, you need to chop up most of your food scraps pretty small so that, and you have red wigglers, and they'll then eat all of your food scraps and then poop them out. And their worm castings are wonderful compost.
Super nutritious. Yeah. Describe where your worms are. I mean, they're actually in your house, in your kitchen?
We Yeah, you can have them in your kitchen. There's specific bins. We actually sell them at the Botanical Garden, but they're, I think they're called a worm factory, but there's various layers so that you can kind of start putting in new scraps in one layer, and then once that gets full, move them to the next, and the worms will move up within the layers. But you can also make them. There's definitely plans to make them with big Tupperware
That's
containers.
That's what I was thinking of, Tupperware. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen Tupperware.
Yeah. We've got a publication on that, Cooperative Extension.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It was useful for me when I started ours a few years ago. I don't have them anymore, but they were fun.
Yeah.
Mine were like pets, you know. Yeah. They were highly caffeinated, so they got all the coffee grounds, and they liked eggs. Sometimes I would just feed them eggs
just to make them happy.
Even though it wasn't waste.
Yeah, just to keep your worms happy. Mm-hmm. We've got a caller. Hi, Greg. You're talking to Hometown Alaska.
Hi, ladies. How are you?
We're great. What's your question?
Well, I've had this ongoing problem with a particular invasive species called bluebells, so I've heard. They've got these nasty long tubers that they burrow down good 10 or 12 inches underground. And I've pulled up a tuber, looks like a carrot, kind of like a white, crunchy, kind of radishy kind of texture to it.
Well, you can eat it. You can eat it.
Well,
I'd rather
kill it.
I had somebody come in who was wondering that, and I had to call poison control. If it's Campanula rapunculoides, that's exactly what it sounds like.
It does.
Yeah. Well, maybe if I threaten it by eating it, it'll go away. But I don't think it's going to be thwarted.
You're doing the right thing.
Pulling it out. Yeah, getting rid of it.
Well, it's growing in and amongst my raspberries and my irises. And it comes from under the fence from the two adjoining neighbors' yards. And they think of it as great-looking cover.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is pretty when it's in bloom. That's going to be a really difficult situation. Even if you were to remove all the perennials and try to hand pick out the roots, I think you're still gonna have a perennial problem with it because it's going to keep coming back under the fence.
Exactly, and I even considered driving some separation devices like these. These plastic wedges that interlock. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know how far down you'd have to go.
I know, and they're only 6 inches deep. So I'm.
It's going to have to be at least 2 feet, if not more.
I know, and there's gas lines, and who knows what's coming.
Uh-oh.
There's one area where I just. It was choking out so much of the other plants that I heard somebody say, spray it with vinegar, and it's that way the vinegar it'll kill everything, but it won't be poisonous to you or your pets. I know we have cats, of course, that like to play in the garden and do other things.
Well, that's not really going to work. The vinegars that are used as herbicides are not your household vinegar. They're industrial strength vinegar, and I haven't checked for 2014, but... to use a product as a pesticide, even though it's a natural product, I'd go on to the DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation website, and see if anybody's selling this type of herbicide that uses the vinegar. I think you have to look up, is it acetic acid? Is that what vinegar
That's
is?
That's what vinegar is, but I don't know.
Yeah,
the
you'd have to look it up under that as the active ingredient. But because you need something systemic, not just something that's going to burn it down, and you are going to change the pH of the soil and lower it.
And it makes everything else have a difficult time. Mm-hmm. But, if I could somehow kill enough of that stuff back where maybe I could, plant a garden on a garden, block off the ground from below, build a wooden garden on a garden type of thing. I'm not sure if the bluebells are so pervasive they will push up around and through and do whatever they can to invade.
Greg, can I ask a question? This is Una. Do you have your raspberry bed? Is it fairly well mulched in and around the plants?
It is, and I also throw on some of the ground cover. What's that stuff? It's the shredded
bark.
Wood chips.
Yeah. Wood chips?
Yeah.
Does that make it easier for you to pull?
I can pick them off, but I took a whole summer really cleaning it out and in around all the raspberries. And then once I did that, I put down weed barrier, and then on top of that, mulched leaves as well as the shredded wood chips. And that seemed to really kept them at bay for 90% of the raspberries. But that far end, where they're leaching in from the neighbor's side, that's pretty much it's turning into
a garden. Your instinct to try and do a barricade might work to a certain degree. I have a friend who had a similar problem, but it was raspberries that were creeping into her yard.
They're pretty vigorous. Yeah.
So.
That problem, maybe. Would they like to eat our raspberries?
Maybe you'd like to send some raspberries over.
Yeah. Well, I did try the vinegar, and it was just store-bought, and it's pretty cheap. I got the gallon, and I put it in a sprayer, and I just doused a test corner in the very far corner, and all of the bluebells shriveled up and died, and they did not come back until the next year.
Hmm. Well, it's a contact. It's not getting into the root system at all. So
seed.
You'd have to do it over and over and over and try to starve it out, but it's being fed by what's on the other side of the fence.
Right. And there's just not much I can do without, you know, my neighbors like it. They say, oh, we like it. It's pretty.
You can bring them something different.
Yeah, maybe introduce them to something else that they might like and that won't cause the same problem.
Here's some raspberries.
there are a lot of campanulas, a lot of, you know, bluebells that are not real aggressive like that.
This batch is. Right?
No, yeah. Well, this particular species is. Uh-huh. Verna Pratt calls it the purple monster.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, Greg, I don't know if we really helped you, but at least you got some empathy here.
I appreciate that.
Well, I can. You know, I think you need to use glyphosate actually, and then not use it again. But you.
Is that an herbicide?
I'm not sure that we'd have to check to make sure that it's labeled for use with the raspberries. And it sounds like you're not interested in that type of a product, but otherwise,
But the systemic problem.
You're going to have this problem, you know, forever.
The systemic problem of it coming under the fence isn't going to go away using herbicide,
which is
the reality.
Greg, thank you.
It.
Yeah, good luck. I know. I have empathy.
Maybe my neighbors are listening.
I say put the roots in soup and, you know, think that they're pretty. And if you can move your raspberries to another location. And then just mow them down. You know, keep them mowed down.
Can I pass on a tip?
Please do.
Okay. Having cats, and they're always in the backyard, we watch them while we don't let them roam the neighborhood. But they chew on everything, and we're trying to be careful with what we put back there. But we're having a lot of mold growing on in between the bricks in our patio, and I tried some of that spray-on stuff that says it won't stain, but it does. And then I discovered it's very toxic to the pets.
Uh-oh.
And then somebody told me once, besides the vinegar, try just pouring boiling water onto the mold.
Getting some shaking heads here, Greg. Agreeing
so,
with
yeah,
you.
I think you're talking about moss, right?
Yeah, moss. Yeah,
moss.
There's two types of moss killers, and some of them just use iron as the active ingredient. There are some, you know, soap products where soap is the active ingredient, but sounds like you've hit on something that works really well. But of the moss killers that you buy, one for the roof, one for the lawns, they're different products, and you really have to be careful because one does stain everything else. But sounds like you don't need it. Sounds like you don't need it. You've got your boiling water, and I bought a weed flamer this last year. I can't wait to use that.
Ooh, that would be
satisfying. That's on my wish list.
Satisfying. So really, what do? Is it like you just... you really get the satisfaction of...
Anne Lovejoy is a organic landscape gardener in the Pacific Northwest, and she's written a number of books that I quite enjoy. And her favorite tool is a flame, as a weed flamer.
You think of gardeners
you get them,
as being so gentle.
I know.
Such gentle people, but no.
Yeah, but you know Kelly's got the hula hoop, so
I'm all about
fire.
Little,
yeah, yeah, we put a little fire in the garden. We have some hula hoop and music.
Well, I promise I'm going to throw out our numbers one more time here for our listeners, but then we're going to talk a little bit about classes because there are a lot of ways to get schooled up on gardening here in Anchorage, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. So you can give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic. And actually, I always try to get our questions on. We have another one right now. Someone wants to know how to kill raspberries. Snickering around the room.
Well, they are definitely, easier than
they are easier
than that campanula that we're talking about. They're not very deep rooted.
Yeah,
yeah.
They're all connected.
Yes, but you can pull them out and...
Just with a sharp spade.
And get them out. Okay, so that's the tip is to pull them out with a sharp spade.
And gloves. Don't forget your gloves.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to come back from little pieces of the root like that Campanula rapunculoides will.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you actually just might, you know, on Craigslist or on FreeCycle, mm-hmm. you know, put something out and have somebody else come over and rip them out for you
exactly.
and take them home.
And pay.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to take another call, but we're going to get to those classes. So we'll take this call. Welcome, Stu. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Thanks. I have a question. I have some lakefront property, and I find the need to pull out some of the muck that fills up my slip. And it's this dark, rich material that comes out, and it looks really good for something. And I'm wondering if it's possible to add something to it, or is that material known for being of any value in gardening?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I think I know what kind of material you're talking about, Stu. This is the stuff that comes out from under the boat slip. It's sort of sludgy and kind of smelly.
Yeah, it's kind of smelly. I imagine it's
The aerobic.
But I don't know, but it has sticks in it, and it just washes back in with the wave action. So I have to pull it out. So
I would just add it to your. I would start a compost, too.
Yeah, it's organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, start it with a compost, and I would consider it part of your carbon source.
Okay, well, it's unlimited, so I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, you would still need to, in order to mix it with green to make it useful, or you could try just mulching with it. You know, it sounds like if it's partially broken down by the bacteria that live under the water, then maybe it would make a neat mulch for you, particularly around your perennials and trees.
You know, if it's smelly.
Particularly stinky, then you'll be careful.
Well, in a compost pile, then when you have something smelly, if you cap it with soil that doesn't smell or
mix it in.
Sawdust and have it on the interior of the pile. That's until it gets broken down and the microorganisms shift over to aerobic decomposers rather than the anaerobic that you've got going now.
Mm-hmm. Good question, Stu.
One other question real quick. Blueberries. It's really a mystery to me. You can find blueberry bushes in bogs and you can walk for miles and not see one berry. And yet other places you can come up and find a group of blueberry bushes and the bog blueberries, and they're just full of blueberries. I have never seen blueberries on a lot of bushes that I've been watching my entire life, and I'm just wondering, did they produce at one time? They must have, and they just don't produce anymore? Or?
I am guessing it's about the pollinators because, you know, it's our native bees that need to do the pollinating, so it depends on what the weather is at that particular time. I think it's all about pollination.
So if there are flowers, then there should be berries. And if there are no berries and you did see flowers, then the pollinators just never made it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I'll
thanks, Stu. We're going to take a question from Tara. Hi, Tara. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. So I have only been in Alaska for 4 growing seasons now, trying my best to garden. but my question is about growing onions. Every time I start my onions and I get them far enough along, the flies come and lay their larvae and work their way down and eat the onions. Is there anything you know of that I can do to deter those besides covering the whole row?
Well, that's what you have to do. You know, it's called it's called exclusion. The onion maggot is one of the earliest, you know, garden pests that we have. And so the eggs are laid on the stems of the onions. They look like little grains of rice. You know, if you don't have rows and rows, you can just actually brush them off. But that when they hatch, the maggot tunnels directly into the stem. And you can really impress children if you, like, slit that stem with your nail and run it down and catch the maggot on the way to the root. So you do have to build, you know, like a frame and use a floating row cover like Rime, it's a spun polyester to actually keep the adult, which is a fly, from laying her eggs.
Okay.
But the other
thing, that there used to be some kind of a spray that you could spray on it, but it must have been too toxic because I haven't seen it on the market for.
Well, diazinon was used for root maggots, but it never worked for the onion maggot because there's no time. I mean, it's a perfect system. The egg hatches, the little maggot is never exposed to anything. It goes right into the leaf, so it is protected.
Right. Okay, so pretty much just exclusion is the best cure for that then.
Yeah, no, if you have them on chives, you can cut the chives, you know, completely off and they'll resprout. You can't do that with your onions, but I would like to see you grow onions from plants this year, not from sets.
Right, yeah.
And most people don't know that, so that will, you know, you'll get off to a stronger start, and maybe your plants will be able to withstand the onion maggot attacks. And, you know, every year is not quite so bad, or every year varies. Sometimes
right.
You have worse problems than others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks, Tara.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yes.
Okay.
And we did get one email that a suggestion for how to kill things. It was rock salt will kill anything you put it on, but it probably changes the environment quite a bit. What do you think?
I would agree.
It will kill, or it will
change the environment.
Change
salt.
Yeah. So you'd have another problem, maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't want anything to grow there ever.
That's what I was thinking. Too much and you'll sterilize the soil.
If that's your goal, and it could be that you don't want...
You really don't want anything.
Want anything to grow in your pathway, or you really don't want...
Those are solutions.
I mean, we see that. That's evidence from when you use too much, any kind of salt.
On your driveway.
On your driveway or your
sidewalk.
Yeah. And then all of that runoff from those things goes into the drain. So it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't
go
away.
It will kill... Kill.
It will kill. It will kill.
Weed
and
burner.
It's not as satisfying as a weed burner. All right.
Weed
I
burner.
Promised we'd talk about classes. So let's start with Una. Let's do a little round robin on things that people might want to jot down and know is available here in Anchorage.
Okay. Well, I will start. One of the big things I would like to talk about is our garden design workshop. The Alaska chapter of the American Society of Landscape Architects offers a garden design workshop each year in this time in April. And it's the perfect time to get started. You pull your plan. We provide two lectures, and we teach you how to approach your property, how to understand what the easements mean, understand your survey that you received when you purchased your home, and walk you through what it is that you would really like from your land. Not what you should do or what your neighbor's doing, but really what you would like from your land. And in the second lecture, we get more into details and planting. So there's two lectures. It's on April 14th and April 22nd. And then the piece that makes it really valuable, the price is $225. And if you've ever tried to work with a professional, the price at first seems steep. But anyway, there's a two-hour design session that you get one-on-one. So you register and you attend the two lectures, take notes, and then you get paired with a designer who will meet your needs. And it's a really great way to...
It's a kind of a blend of do-it-yourself and expert advice.
Right. Yeah, so yeah. We prep you with these two lectures, and you get some homework.
Uh-huh.
And then you come prepared for this two-hour design session where you work with a designer who will help you work through any of your issues or questions or doubts.
Yeah.
Or wonderments.
Yes.
Or big ideas.
Yeah.
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 And so that is on Saturday, 26th. And so you can register by emailing me at gardendesignworkshop@gmail.com, or you can visit our website, akasla.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For more information.
Let's give Kelly a chance. You said you had some classes at the Botanical Garden you wanted folks to know about. And, of course, you've got Master Gardener classes. And anyway, but we'll work our way to Julie. But let's go to the Botanical Garden.
Sure. We have a few workshops. Now is also the perfect time to be pruning your fruit trees. That's something else that you can do. In
April?
In April.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm learning about fruit trees myself, but we're going to have Dan Elliott of the Pioneer Fruit Growers Association coming out to the Botanical Garden for a hands-on workshop and pruning demonstration on April 21st at 6 p.m. We also have, if gardening maybe isn't your forte, but you love the wildflowers of Alaska, we're having a wildflower photography class with Alan Rokash. He is a well-known photographer. He'll be coming up in mid-June. And then we also have a organic food gardening class with Julie Riley here. She'll be coming to the Botanical Garden mm-hmm. and teaching a two-week intensive in May. And all through the summer, we'll have workshops July and August, Wednesdays in the woods at the Botanical Garden. So you can check us out at www.alaskabg.org.
Wow. Okay. Great. And Julie, I always see you at the Saturday market, and you're always, but are you, I saw an herb study group that was on cooperative, and also Master Gardeners meeting, but
Yes. Okay. So tomorrow, Friday, the herb study group meets at noon, from noon to 1:30, and the topic of discussion is perilla, which is an herb that is used ornamentally. The Japanese use it. Many Korean gardeners have a type of perilla they call sesame leaf. So everybody is welcome. It's free.
Oh,
Master Gardener's third Monday, drip irrigation.
All right. My goodness, we're out of time. We had so much fun. I really want to thank our guests, Julie Riley from Cooperative Extension, Kelly Ingram from Alaska Botanical Garden, and Una Martin with the Landscape Architects here. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Charles Wolforth is back discussing alternative ways to worship with local spiritual leaders. Please connect with us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Our website is alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Monica Goki is our audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.